You're listening
to Welcome to Comics, episode number
316. This week, we talk about the Flintstones. Visit welcometocomics.com, hear past episodes, see what we're reading next, or send us feedback. This show is supported by listeners like you. Access bonus episodes by becoming a patron today at patreon.com/welcometocomics. And now,
the cast begins.
Oh, I did finish watching Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, yeah.
I'm all caught up.
So I got like 2 weekends ago or something, you sent me the text about Killy.
Yes.
No, she is the best. Yeah. I love her.
And I mean, like, I listened to a podcast about the show and I don't like the main podcast, but like they do kind of 3 or 4 episodes a week on different things. Like they do one where they do a commentary with the show, one with fan reactions, one with this and that. But one of the ones is just this guy who's been watching Star Trek forever, and he like started the Star Trek network, the podcast network, and it's like his notes on it. And like he goes through and is like, well, you know, they mentioned that there's 24 Klingon houses, so I'm going to tell you what everyone in canon that we know of is and how you or may not know them and what the other ones probably are and the context for where they were in the history. Like that was the first episode of his like notes. I was like, that's beautiful. I can't wait to listen to this every time. And he made a comment that like he at the end of the show, he's like, he's completely blown away by the acting because most of these people are people he hadn't heard of before, really. Mm-hmm. And these people are like asked to play a part. Within a part.
Yeah.
Like some of the acting is phenomenal.
Oh, wait. David, have you seen any of Discovery yet?
I've not finished it.
Okay. Okay.
Don't worry about spoilers. It's fine.
Well, I'm trying to be non-spoilery.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it's the acting is so good.
Yeah, I was really pleased. Like, I know everyone was like, oh, it's so dark, but I was like, but it's done so well. Like, these people, I believe them.
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's the thing, too. Like, it is fundamentally a different feel from every other Star Trek show that's been put out there. But that's fine, you know? Like, my wife really doesn't like it. She really would rather just watch DS9, so... that's what we're doing instead. And like, that's great. That's fine. I love DS9 and I'm happy to watch it again. And she's only seen it once, so she's happy to watch it again. And like, there's like 28 seasons or something ridiculous of other Star Trek you can go and watch. Like, it's fine.
And I actually really love that it was added to the whole repertoire because now I feel like there's this wonderfully broad range for Star Trek. Like, if you want like kind of beat 'em up action and womanizing, you can watch original series. If you want a morality play, you can watch TNG. If you want like a modern dark retelling, you have Discovery. And it's like, no matter what you're in the mood for, now there is a Star Trek for it. And I am just so psyched about that fact.
Yeah. And I like it. I think that's what Star Trek's strength now versus, say, Stargate, which I also, I really, really love Stargate. But there's like, I think the original was 10 seasons and Atlantis was like 6 more. And then there's Universe. And Universe is very different. But like those first like 16 seasons, they're all like the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So I could not watch
Universe.
Yeah. If you don't like episode 1 of Stargate, you don't need to watch the other 15 seasons because it doesn't change a whole lot.
That's why I didn't even finish the first season of Stargate.
It does. It gets better, but it doesn't fundamentally change. The same way that like TNG, the first season sucks, but it gets better. But the idea is basically the same. It's an episodic morality play where they're going to run into an alien of the week or a this of the week. You know, like it's the same show for all 7 seasons of TNG, but it gets better as it goes. And Stargate definitely gets way better as it goes. It gets better and better and better and better and better. But it's still the same thing.
I really wish. So like for Babylon 5, some brave soul put together a list of the essential episodes if you want to know the main plot, and you it, like, because a lot of season one is like monster of the, well, not monster of the week, but like morality play of the week. Mm-hmm. And someone put together like every episode you need to watch if you just want like the main thrust of the drama. And I wish someone would do that for Stargate.
Yeah.
I would rewatch it if I only had to watch select episodes.
Does the Babylon 5 list include the episode where Garibaldi and Lanier rebuild a motorcycle?
I believe it does, yes.
God, the episode was so random.
It is an important episode.
I went to like rewatch it and I was like, what is going on here? And then they like ride it down around in the station.
I mean, it's like definitional bromance. It's beautiful.
You know, yeah. What's hilarious is I've never seen Babylon 5, but I always hear that DS9 is a ripoff of it. And you're talking about two characters building an outdated piece of technology like that. And the first thing I thought of was the episode where Sisko builds a soldier sailor and flies it with his son for no good. It's like,
see, Andy,
for no reason.
The episode where they build the motorcycle, it's not like generic motorcycle. It's literally like a Kawasaki motorcycle from the 90s.
Yeah. And they do it like while sitting under a portrait of Daffy Duck.
Yeah.
I really do want to watch Babylon 5. Maybe that's what we'll try next. We're finishing up Rebels now.
You should. It will contextualize it for anyone who wonders why my husband calls me a moon-faced assassin of joy. It's probably as insulting as it sounds, but it's like way funnier if you know what the context is.
All right.
So the thing with Babylon 5 is the CGI is extremely dated.
Oh, yeah.
You have to get over that when you watch this. But the show is really good. It's great. It's a great show.
Yeah, I think that's not something we'd have a problem getting over. We watch really corny stuff. It's fine.
Oh, no, Andy, I don't think you understand what I'm saying to you.
Well, okay, I personally have watched and enjoyed Farscape. So
have you,
Andy,
played a video game in 1992?
Yeah, do you remember the X-Wing games?
Yeah.
X-Wing and TIE Fighter? Yeah, the show looks like that.
Okay. Well, I mean, mm-hmm. Okay. Because I've also tried to play KOTOR a couple times and I've had difficulty but not because the graphics are bad, because the game design is dated.
Well, so fortunately,
we're going to drop you on Terrace and give you no direction whatsoever. Okay.
The thing with Babylon 5 is there's not a ton, at least in the early bits of the show, there's not a ton of like space shots where you really see the graphics. I don't know what I'm saying, because it's like I'm trying to talk you out of watching it. You really need to watch the show.
Yeah.
It's really good.
It's also like, it will not waste your time after the first season, because JMS wrote it as a 5-season story. Mm-hmm. He had the whole thing done before they even started. So it has a direction and it goes there.
I forget that Krasinski did that.
I think season one is, like many shows, is probably the roughest, because I think even though Straczynski had his, like Jen said, had the story planned out, I think the show was still trying to find its, not its footing, but find its audience. So there was like, I think there's some stuff that is kind of, you know, not essential to the story, but I really like Babylon 5, and I think I want to rewatch it now that we're talking about it.
Yeah, I kind of do too.
Yeah, and season one usually kind of isn't the best season. I mean, TNG, DS9, like all of the Star Treks are famously bad first seasons.
Well, like people say, like you said, Babylon 5 is sometimes said to be a ripoff, or DS9 is a ripoff of Babylon 5. I think because the shows came out so close to each other, and there's a lot of parallels where, like, you know, it takes place on a space station. The first season doesn't really have like a overarching story, but then as the show goes on, there's like a big war. So, the politics are very different in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
It's good. Just watch it.
Yeah. And what they do have in common is like, it's good people who are generally just and see themselves as just trying to do good things. And that can be really satisfying, but I should stop gushing.
Ooh, here we go. IO9, massive Stargate graph attempts to chart out every SG-1 story arc. Beautiful.
Oh, God.
No, because I really do want... I think my wife is, like, really into, like, NCIS kind of shows, like, crime shows and stuff.
Procedural stuff.
And military kind of things, too. Like, that's... She likes watching that kind of stuff. Which I think is part of why Star Trek went over so well with her. Is, sure, it's exploration, but the feel of the ship is more militaristic. So, like, I honestly think she would love Stargate, because it is, like, some Monster of the Week stuff. There's story threads that carry through, but they're slow burn, just like procedural shows, and they've got the military thing going on, and I honestly believe she'll love it, but we're trying to just do, like, every episode through season one, and there's just so many stinkers right up front. It's not working.
You should try Babylon 5 with her, then, because there's the Earth-like space government is far more militaristic than the Federation.
All right. I'll have to, yeah.
I think you guys should maybe, like, watch a couple of the Essential episodes, and if you guys really like it, go back and watch all of it.
Yeah.
And we don't mind slogging through a bad first season, too. Like, my wife was real iffy about Avatar, but I was like, just give it to the finale of season one. And if after that finale you're not in, then okay. But
yeah, I mean, Babylon 5 season one's not... It's bad in the way that, like, the first season of Deep Space Nine or TNG is bad. Or it's not really bad. It's just that compared to what comes later, it's not that great.
Yeah, it's bland. It's just boring sci-fi.
Okay. Because the worst example of that I've ever seen is one that my old roommate Shelby showed me. Buffy season one is horrendous.
Oh, man.
It's just so bad.
Swim team monsters.
There's an episode where the main villain is a giant praying mantis. Like, it's just bad.
That's Power Ranger shit right there.
Yeah, no. It gets really good, but, like, ugh. Do you guys want to talk about this with comic?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, but
no, I'm just kidding. I really like this comic. I had a great time reading it.
This week's comic.
This week we read The Flintstones by Mark Russell. This is another in our Best of 2017 series. We've done a lot of these. I was really, like, looking forward to this too much, I think, and I was ready to be let down, and I so was. This is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. It was great. I wasn't really sure what I was getting into, in that I didn't know what to expect, and I like that it's episodic, and there's not, like, a overarching story where Fred, like, I don't even know what he would try to do in an overarching story, because it's the Flintstones, and it just wouldn't make sense.
Yeah, I mean this as, like, the highest possible compliment, because I keep buying the Archie comics by Mark Waid. I just devour them, and this reminded me of that in the just best way. This comic had me in tears on, like, both sides of the emotional spectrum.
Yeah, I think why this works so well, for me at least, is, David, you were saying, like, you know, why bother having an overarching story? Because what the fuck is Fred? It's the Flintstones. And I think this comic works brilliantly because Mark Russell sees that. And he's like, this is the Flintstones. This is not groundbreaking literature. It's not going to be anything crazy or fancy. So we don't have to take ourselves seriously. And we can have fun all over the place. We can have Professor Sargon, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Right? There's so many great, like, joke little kind of things in here. And all that stuff works so well. And you stop taking it seriously. And then, like, the war gets mentioned. And in issue one, they go to a veteran support meeting, which really throws you off guard in the context of the comic is set up before that, with the Cro-Mags and the Neanderthals and shitty Mr. Slate. Like, it's all fun and games, but then, like, oh yeah, Barney and I have a veterans meeting to go to for our PTSD. Like, wait, what? And it shows you that in just as earnest and authentic a way as it shows you everything else, and treats it all the same, as if this is somehow the way the world is for these people. And I think that balance of the two parts playing off of each other, like, it just works over and over and repeatedly hits home. I the balance in this is insane, and I think I love it. I love it so much. I want to buy so much of this.
Well, what's cool about it, like you said, the you know, in the first issue, we have them go to their support group, and in that instance, it is a little bit surprising because this is like supposed to be a funny comic, and it is funny, but after that, it becomes, it doesn't become out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. Because this is just the world that they live in. And so we get, and, you know, obviously this comic does a lot of pop, like, relevant commentary on things that are happening in the real world, mm-hmm. but are also kind of, like, timeless in the way that, God, this is going to sound ridiculous, in that, like so to me, when I think of literature, I think of stories that are set in their, they make sense in their time period, but the message they convey is like a timeless message. And so
yeah.
The Flintstones is kind of like that, because the Flintstones comic, in that, you know, these things happen in the comic, and it's just these people living their lives, but it's making a commentary that's relevant to us, and it would be relevant like 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And it'll probably still be relevant 40 years from now.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, it's just really interesting, you know?
Yeah. Like you're saying that, I'm thinking about the issue where they talk about marriage. And I mean, there's kind of a social political commentary about marriage and the role of marriage and the civilization in the society. But there's a big component of that comic that's just about, like, why do you love somebody? Like, mm-hmm. the person that you've mm-hmm. chosen to marry, why that person? And what does that mean to you? Like, that's a relevant question throughout human history. And the fact that you can examine it on, like, multiple different levels because you've said it in the context of the Flintstones of all fucking things. It's great.
Yeah, Fred's character allowed, like, the way they portrayed him here allowed the comic to just reach real depths of, like, exploring ideas and emotions behind things. Like, for example, you know, you mentioned the marriage retreat thing. Fred's answer of, like, well, being married is a kind of life insurance policy. That's a really deep take on a serious issue. And he has, like, this really just real human response that I think a lot of people have thought, if maybe not voiced. And it, as you said, Andy, it's really balanced well too, because the stuff going on around that is really goofy. Like, there's a bickering old couple.
Yeah.
You know, like a stereotype. And then the stereotype of, like, the young couple who is like, we'll love each other forever. And you have the lightness there, but also Fred is there to guide the reader into thinking, like, no, this is, like, a real discussion. This is not just playing on stereotypes of what a relationship is.
Yeah, and I think what makes this work, in especially in that part of it, is because you're talking about, like, the, it plays off of the kind of tropes of the old couple and the young couple, but also, because the Flintstones, you can have an angry mob arguing that polygamy is what's right for children. You know, like,
yeah.
Like, and that gets into, like, different social commentary too, but that's another backdrop in this comic that, like, what? Like, you can, that conversation almost uniquely happens in a setting like this where you're talking about the Flintstones.
What I think the comedy does, it helps you see how ridiculous some of the arguments against, like, so if you put it through the lens of our current social and political climate, to me at least, it makes you just see how ridiculous people who are so against, like, marriage equality are. Like, the argument just doesn't make any sense. And I think it's really neat that the way that they do it in this comic.
Yeah, Fred's story, yeah. about the couple when they're growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even a common argument that you hear today against marriage equality is it goes against tradition. And it is really good satire in the Flintstones comic when they say, yeah, well, back when I was young, everyone just went and had sex in the sex cave. And against every like 2018 tradition, I say with air quotes, that we have. So it's like, but yeah, that is like, if you take it far enough back, it's not like marriage was an institution. It's something that we made and something we can change, and that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the sex cave jokes just really cracked me up. Like, oh man.
The other thing I do want to talk about, that as I was getting to the end of issue 6 tonight, reading in advance of this, I think my absolute favorite part of this comic is one of the few threads that does carry over from issue to issue, and it's the church and Gerald. It was more, and then it was the vacuum cleaner. I remember the vacuum cleaner's name, and then it was Gerald. Yeah. And like, they had practical reasons for worshiping Morp, right? Like, they explained, like, Morp, this bird thing, like, led us to warmer weather, led us to the water. Like, he was looking out for us, and we watched him. Like, okay, cool, sure. That's a practical thing. I understand why you would worship that bird. Okay. But then they have civilization, and their needs change, so they try to find a new god, because Morp turns into a record player. And so for, like, a hot second, they worship the vacuum. And then they're like, oh, no, it's a vacuum cleaner. And then they worship Gerald, which is just like, you know, the invisible chair. Except in 6, by the end of issue 6, I was like, maybe they should be worshiping the vacuum cleaner, because that elephant's like talking about, like, the bright part of my day is seeing you. And maybe what's meaningful in our existence is how we look forward to each other. Like, maybe you all should have been worshiping the vacuum cleaner. And it's like a really good commentary about like what you choose to believe and what you choose to see and how deeply you choose to examine what you're looking at and hearing and experiencing in your life. And like, that is not only like that major theme carried through with the church, but that's like the point of this comic too, is like, how closely are you choosing to examine these things? Because I can give it to you here in the context of Flintstones and you're reading in this comic, but when you put the comic down and go on to your life, do you carry that through? Like, how much do you look at what you're doing? And like, that's so good. Like, it's ridiculous. I feel ridiculous calling the Flintstones literature, but that's something good literature does.
Yeah, and I don't think it's ridiculous at all. I think that this comic touches on some really important ideas. Like, to build on what you were saying about, you know, how do you carry these things with you? It's also, when do you choose to let them go because they're no longer benefiting you? And that's a powerful thing to say about like deeply held beliefs like religion, because they start with Morp, and then it's like the same issue, like comic issue, that is dealing with the new fad of crap.
Yeah.
Right. So then it's like this critique of capitalism, and they're like, well, it's all good as long as it makes you like each other and be happy and nice. Or, you know, like, I forgot what the exact wording, and the other guy was like, you sound like a Unitarian, which is good. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, it makes you feel good. And then it ends with, well, buying all this stuff is not making them feel good. It's making them burdened. So you pare down to what's essential. And maybe you need to do that by getting rid of Morp and the vacuum cleaner and simply saying, like, okay, I now worship an imaginary dude in a chair, because that is what you need at the moment. Just like, maybe you did need your goat lawnmower thing, but now you don't. Power goat. Yeah. God, that goat was good.
Oh, time to put you away for 3 weeks. Power goat? Yeah, and I looked it up. The vacuum cleaner's name is Peaches.
Oh, poor yeah, Peaches.
Because he was cute. They wanted to worship him because he was cute.
It broke my heart a little when they were like, Peaches, you'll always have a place in our church. And he's like, really? And then they start vacuuming with him.
Yeah.
Like, aw. Poor guy.
Man, even like the stuff with Mr. Slate, comes around, because in issue one he's a complete fucking asshole and you hate him, but then in issue six, when the world is gonna end and he's sad and alone by himself, you're like, oh, I mean, you're a dick, but oh.
It's like, it's also good character development, right? Like, maybe he's such a dick because he feels like he has something to prove because no one likes him and he has no friends. And then you're like, oh man, this dude.
Yeah. In a Flintstones, like, I keep coming back to that because, like, we put this on the best of list and, you know, there's a lot of good comics, but I was legitimately, like, I was looking forward to this, but not honestly expecting a ton because it's the Flintstones. But maybe that's why I was continually caught off guard by how good this was, because my expectations were low because there's the Flintstones on the cover. And that might have been a purposeful creative decision here, in which case, bravo. Like, a lot of what a reader comes to with a comic, and, you know, like some people say, like, the title of your book doesn't matter. What matters is, you know, the 100 and 300, 400, 800 pages after that. And the story that you develop, or the thousands of pages after that, if you develop a really long, like, multi-book story, the name of it doesn't matter. But the other side is that, you know, the name and the cover are the very first thing that people see and pick up and think about. And one of my favorite examples of that is The Things They Carried, which the title is here nor there, but there's a page in the front of the book where he tributes the book to characters within the book. So he's like, this is to... This, I don't remember that. It's like, this is to, you know, Fred and Wilma, right? And then the book has Fred and Wilma as characters. And so unless you knew better, it sets you up to believe that it's nonfiction, that it's somebody's actual memoirs of going through war. But the whole thing is fiction. Like, the author is able to set up your expectations from the cover and the design of the cover. And then on the tribute page and the pages leading up to what the text actually is, they're able to alter your expectations and alter the way that you come to the text before you really even start reading. And I don't know if it's a purposeful decision on Mark Russell's part to do this kind of thing in the Flintstones, but I think that's another part of why this works. Like, I pick this up and I look at the cover and it's ridiculous and funny. And it immediately sets up my expectations as a reader when I come to this book. And even by issue six, when I should have known better, I see the cover and I laugh. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, that's really pointed commentary about war with the tree people.
Well, I mean, that's what's great about the comic. You know, you look at, like you're saying, Andy, you have a certain expectation when you see the cover and the title. And, you know, Flintstones is originally a comedy cartoon. And when you read this comic, it delivers on that promise. It is a funny comic, but I think what's great about it is you do get what you're paying for, but it gives you something unexpected and something poignant in a lot of ways. But at the same time, like, I was just scrolling through and I'm looking at issue, I think this is issue three, and, you know, it's where the aliens are coming in and Wilma's working on her art and she's talking about how the handprints represent, you know, oh, it's yeah. The family. And then all of a sudden, one of the aliens pokes his head in the window and throws up in their house. He goes, galactic breath. And like, and, you know, this didn't occur to me at the time, but knowing where the story with the handprints goes and what that means to Wilma, really, like, it's a really meaningful scene, you know, but it's also juxtaposed with the alien barfing. And so the comic in just one page delivers delivers on both of its promises. And so that's what I think makes this comic so successful. So yeah, that's what I want to say.
I just like the end. It was like a Bam Bam speech, or was it Pebble speech for voting? And that's all I want to say. Like, yeah, no, pork body ends that way, and that's all I want to say. Not to call you pork body. I just thought
that was totally a meta decision on my part. That's a coincidence.
Yeah, I forgot about the thing with Wilma and the handprints and stuff. Like, that's...
That was really meaningful when she explained why she works with handprints. And now, going back and seeing the... You know, seeing the alien throw up next to it. It's good times.
Spring break! it's funny, spring break is next week at my school. That's what some of my employees will be doing.
Visiting bedrock and throwing up.
Yeah, collecting bread. I don't know. I am a tried and true reader response critic. Like, my belief is that if you don't put something in the comic, then it's not there. And I don't care what your intention was, because I didn't get it. But like, if you want to hear a good argument against that kind of thing, Wilma's paintings and her story is a good argument against it. Like, knowing Wilma's story and knowing the intentionality behind how she paints is definitely something that completely alters and colors and enhances your viewing of her paintings. Like, it's really good. It's really good, like, a fundamental question of art criticism and what you believe as a reader. Like, that's a good example in there too. I did appreciate that. I'm like, oh, poor Wilma. That sucks for you that nobody likes your paintings.
But I think it also says that it's okay, you know, because they mean something to her.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't have to play to the crowd, right?
Yeah.
And the art critics are caricatures, right? So it's, yeah. I think we're supposed to be like, look at these assholes. And it does that. It's successful.
Yeah, and Fred comes in and he's like, you got picked for this and that's great, and these people think that and that sucks, but at the end of the day, you aren't doing this for them, and you aren't doing this for acclaim. You're doing this for you. And that's what's important. And I'm like, damn, Fred.
Yeah, Fred is...
You a
Fred
good husband.
He's very good. He's very emotionally intelligent.
Yeah.
That's a great way to phrase it.
And you know what's funny is because he's totally... Like, we recognize him as Fred Flintstone. But he's very different from the Fred Flintstone that we see in the cartoon, where he's like a Homer Simpson type character. And here he's not. Like, I think Homer, or to a certain degree, Peter Griffin from Family Guy, they're, you know, they're sometimes unintentionally poignant. But I think Fred is just, he's just a smart guy. But he's not like Dr. Sargon, where he advertises it.
Yes.
He's really vulnerable. And I think that's what makes him such a good character here. Anytime he's feeling something, he takes the time to voice it in a way that we very, very often don't see in any media, really, unless it's supposed to be this like big emotional moment. And he is saying things that I think every person has thought or felt at some point. And what makes it so good here is that it's not a big emotional moment a lot of the time. It's these little moments where, you know, he's at a marriage retreat, just like talking to a dude wearing a funny hat. Or he's like hanging out with his best friend, you know, at the veterans hall. Like, it's just these little things where it's fairly unprompted. And he tells, like, a deeply human truth. And I think that's something that we actually don't get without, you know, this huge amount of dramatic buildup in a lot of media.
Yeah. Because, and those moments in life do exist. And there's no drama around them when they really happen. You know? And I think that's something we as a culture build up. Like, I'm listening to Felicia Day's audiobook of her memoir right now, and she mentions in that a couple times, like, this feeling that you get when you watch a lot of TV or read a lot of books, that there's some feeling of destiny or purpose to what you do, as if you were in the context of of the media that you consume. But it never works out that way. And Fred here is a really good example of it doesn't have to work out that way. It can still be impactful and still be meaningful and still enrich your life without having there be trumpets in the background or somebody weeping. Like, you can just live your life authentically. It's fine. You can be Fred.
Yeah. I think a strength of this comic is that it takes place, like, with the first humans, right? They're always talking about, like, oh, they were cave people, and they became human, they became civilized. And that gives the comic a lot of room within its own plot and context to explore what it means to be human and what it means to be a citizen as opposed to someone who is just surviving. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like these people are getting on a higher plane, and it's really satisfying to watch because it gives all the like oomph of good character development without having to show us that development. There's enough backstory context of like, well, I lived in a cave and it was really shitty. Mm-hmm. That you don't have to worry about like what horrible thing happened in their past, you know, to give these moments more weight. It's just, like a lot more relatable because of that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. The issue one kind of brings that up immediately too. Like there are people who are walking around the museum like, wow, imagine how hard it must have been to have lived back then. You know, like we come to this comic with all the backstory we need. Like life without civilization, obviously really blue. You know, and every once in a while they give you more context, like Wilma and the hand painting and stuff and how it was difficult for them. And, you know, you lose somebody, you come back and there's all these hands of the people who came before you. And you get the thing with Fred and his journey back and forth where it was difficult, but the gay couple was there, and without their help, they, you know, other people might have been lost. And even then in the first issue, you get context that even with civilization, it's still kind of brutal and shitty when the fight happens and the loser gets knocked out and then eaten by fucking pterodactyls in the background of the art. Like, it's still shitty and it still sucks, but at least it's better than that. And like, you can imagine all of the context that you need. You don't have to have those gaps filled in. You're right. That's part of what makes this so good. You don't need a gritty prac story for Fred. It's just being a fucking person before civilization existed. That's a gritty backstory enough. What did you guys think of Barney and Betty in this?
They didn't solidify for me until I found out how they got Bam Bam.
Yeah. I think they were kind of like not background characters, but they were definitely in the supporting role until like Jen said, we found out about the circumstances of their relationship before the war and then after Bam Bam came along.
Yeah, and I think I think they work good as a foil because they also seem like balanced, rational individuals. And it's probably because, you know, they're friends with Wilma and Fred, who seem like balanced, rational individuals, so I kind of attribute those same things to them. But whereas Fred and Wilma feel stable and show us the happy life of that family, you get kind of a feeling that Betty and Barney aren't all the time. especially in the beginning of that last issue, before they get Bam Bam, when Betty's like, wow, I really want to be happy for you, but we're having this problem in our life right now, and it's kind of tearing apart our marriage. And you're like, oh, damn, Real Gauntlet just dropped again. Hi, comic. <Yeah. laughs> And, like, that's something that, you know, you experience. And I think now, too, in the world of social media, it's something that you have to be more careful with. Like, I have friends who have difficulty having children, and I know that they do. And so it makes even something like posting online difficult. Like, I have a second kid coming and you have had a hard time getting one and you may never get one. And like, I want to sit here and trumpet my happiness, you know, and like, I shouldn't feel guilty for that, but I also don't want to make you feel like shit. And those interactions are difficult to navigate. And there's a fraction of that in here too, with, you know, Betty brings it up with Wilma, but Barney doesn't really say a whole lot. You know, he kind of clams up, and Fred just kind of like is willing to gloss over it a little bit and doesn't ever question why Bam Bam comes back with them. And there's even in this comic where for the most part people are open and genuine and authentic, it still recognizes that there are situations and relationships where you maybe can't be all the time or aren't comfortable being that way all the time. And I like that, you know, we talk about in context of Fred being able to just drop those emotional intelligence bombs all over the place. But Barney can't, and that's fine. Barney can still live his life too. Barney can still be a good bro and go to the fucking veterans hall with you. I think that's why I like him in this too, because it gives this comic a texture of openness that I think wouldn't exist without Betty and Barney playing that role.
Yeah, Barney is a good middle ground, because otherwise your only real, like, I guess, foil is Mr. Slate, right? Who cannot bring himself to voice why he wants people to come over. You know, he likes to say, oh, I'm very important, or I have a hot tub at my mansion, or, you know, look at this new dessert that my turtle servant can make. Yeah. But what he really wants to say is, I am lonely. I do not want to die alone. Please be my friend. And Fred, you know, on the other hand, is just like spilling his guts every which way. So like Barney's kind of the healthy middle ground of like, yeah, this is how most people are. They have a lot of trouble not clamming up over certain topics, but are otherwise, you know, able to communicate what they're thinking. It's hard to grasp who Barney is, I think, because of that, because he seems like a more like bland character for the first five issues. And then you get to the point where like you start to understand his motivations. Otherwise, he's just kind of like guy next door, right? Mm. But once you understand like that he is not just a best friend trope, he has these emotions that make him tick, and we get to see them, like he becomes fleshed out and interesting.
I really want to read so much more of this.
Yeah. I'm excited because the full volume of the trade comes out in 7 days.
Ooh,
so yeah. I'm going to get that, and then I get to wait like another year for the second one or whatever.
Yeah. We haven't talked about the art yet.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is a shame because it's fucking phenomenal.
The faces are so good.
Yeah. The faces are good. The details, the background stuff is fantastic. Down to like the animals in the background of scenes doing wacky shit, or like in the boxing fight when the pterodactyls come down and eat the loser. there's fantastic details all over this. And I know some of it's influenced with the writer too, like the funny names of the different places that are around, like Outback Snake House.
Yeah.
You know, there's funny stuff in there that I'm sure is, you know, a team effort. But I know there's stuff in here that the artist is just like, I'm going to sneak some shit in the background here because it's fucking Flintstones and let's make some fun thing happen. Like, it's great. Because it works on those same levels. It does a really good job of sneaking funny shit in the background to add context and depth to the humor of this world. But like you were saying, Jen, the face work just brings it back home when it wants to get serious again. Because Fred can have a real good, earnest face, and Wilma can be present in the moment too. And that art works on the same multiple levels as the writing.
Dr. Sargon, exactly like Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Yes. But without the short sleeves. I love that nobody has short sleeves.
Well, they're cave people. They haven't invented sleeves, just televisions.
So before we get to rating this, I want to ask, is there a favorite moment you guys had in this comic?
You know, I hadn't really thought about it until we started talking, but I think mine is the page with the handprints and the alien barfing. Because I think that really kind of captures the essence of what this comic is all about. Because even if you don't know that the importance of the handprints when you read that scene, you get a nice family scene. You get to see all the Flintstones together, being a family, like you know, Wilma's doing her painting, and Fred and Pebbles are watching her paint, and then they're kind of joking around because you know, he's trying to like put paint on her face, and that's something that a family would do. And I think it just, but then you have the alien barfing at the in the last panel, and I think it does a good, like I said, does a good job of captures what this comic is all about.
Yeah, I gotta say, I think mine mine is also in the first issue, when Fred takes the Cro-Mags or the Neanderthals out to work, and they're like, "So Fred, I got a question for you." He's like, "Yeah, sure. How come you wear that tie?" He was like, "You know, I read this article once. You should dress for the job that you want, not the job you have." "Oh, how long have you been wearing that tie?" 15 years. The look on his face is just horrendous. It's just like utter defeat in the moment of somebody calling him out and making him realize the ridiculousness of his tie. And just the face work there is just so good. And then the next panel is somebody breaking rock with a power goat. Like, I think it was that moment when I realized what I was getting into with this comic, because it's funny, and then there's a panel, just a flash of serious depth, and then back to funny. And it's just like, wait, did I really just catch what I caught there? And then the next page. You know? And it's like, that did such a good job of setting up the tone of this whole book. And also, like, I wear a tie. I don't need to. Why the fuck do I wear a tie to work?
Don't.
How long have I been wearing this goddamn tie? So you know what? I did not wear a fucking tie today. Boom. Thank you, Flintstones.
Fred totally inspired you.
That's true. Oh, and the explanation of what Yabba Dabba Doo means. I love that one, too.
Oh, yeah. That's like, heartbreaking.
Oh. That just makes... Because that retcons all of this entire franchise to be super depressing.
Yeah.
Jen, did you have a favorite?
Yeah, I did. And I think it's telling that it is also one of those moments that mixes something serious with humor. It's in the marriage issue where right after Fred has told the story of Adam and Steve, which those name choices just really cracked me up. I love that. That was good. The marriage retreat counselor dude sits down and he's like, "Wow, I guess I have a lot of thinking to do." And then the final frame is like, Adam, Steve, Wilma, and Fred standing there, and then the guy walking away with his guitar, and it's just all white in the background, and he's like, "But I probably won't." Yeah. It's just like, oh man, they nailed it. Right? Like, Fred has this great emotional story full of meaning about people he cares about, and the guy's like, "That's a good point, but nah." And it's just... Like, obviously, you know, it doesn't always go down like that, but it is just such a, like, in the moment, like, 2018 type of scene. I guess it just captures the, like, the levity and satire that's all wrapped up in this so well.
All right. We want to rate this?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, before we rate it, I want to say, no matter what we say when we rate it, which I think is going to be positive anyway, and for any comic y'all read, and any comic we've read for this show, before we rate it, I want to thank them, because thank you, Mark Russell, thank you, Steve Pooh, for doing the pencil, Steve Pug, I don't know how you'd pronounce that, I think it's not Pooh.
Probably not.
Colors, Chris Chukri, letters, Dave Sharp, editor, Brittany Holzer and Marie Javins, and everybody else up and down the line at DC Comics, who got this thing printed and in my hands to read. Like, if you hadn't done the work and put in the effort and wrote and drew and made the thing, we wouldn't be able to sit here and talk about it. And I'm going to go first, because I never go first, and usually I don't go first because it's difficult, but this time it's easy, so I'm going to go first. I'm going to give this a 5. I can't think of any reason not to love this comic and share it with everyone, so I'm gonna put it on my wife's iPad tonight while she's in sleep, and she's gonna have it tomorrow for her lunch break. I'm gonna force it upon her. And I'm gonna buy this trade and give it to people to read, because I think this is fantastic, and I don't know many people who wouldn't like it. And it just, like we've been saying over and over, like everything seems to work on almost every level in this comic. So 5. See? Easy. David, what you got?
Yeah, I mean, this is an easy 5. This comic, I don't have any complaints about it. I guess my complaint is that I wish I had more to read than this is for 6 issues. But fortunately, there are more, so I can get them. But I don't have anything bad to say about this comic. I thoroughly enjoyed everything about it. So yeah, this is an easy 5 for me.
Sweet. Jen?
Same. I mean, I think this joins Craven's Last Hunt in the list of 2 comics so far that verge on perfect. Like, there is nothing bad to say about this. It is a story that asks us as readers, what is it to be civilized? And it says to us, you may answer that it means having technology, having stuff, having the ability to wage war and be powerful. But no, it's about the people around you and how you treat them. And it is such an important and good message. And it does it with humor and grace. And the characters, they took like a really goofy freaking cartoon that was on reruns during my childhood. Right. And they made it into something so like at once funny and poignant. And I just, oh, this is so good. I cannot wait for more. My only complaint, like David, is that it's not available yet. I don't want to wait a year for volume 2. I want it now.
You talk about how it's crappy rerun cartoons and stuff. And I was thinking like, man, I remember, didn't they have a live action thing for a little while there?
Oh God. Yeah. That was really bad.
There were movies, right?
In the 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. And like when somebody says,
well, John, with John Goodman, right? John Goodman.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. He played Fred. Right.
Like, but for me, when somebody says Flintstones, the very first thing I think of is the vitamins.
Oh, yeah. I used to, like, sneak those as a kid, right? You know, you wanted, like, another. But yeah. You shouldn't, because they're not candy.
Nope. You're going to have lead poisoning. Or no, iron poisoning. I don't know. Whatever it is. When you have too much of the thing. Anyway, yeah, this is, like, the easiest 5 we've had in a long time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, that is it for this week, though. Next week, we are going to read You and a Bike in a Road by Eleanor Davis. That'll continue our Best of 2017 series. If you want to see what we have coming up after that, you can go to welcometocomics.com. On the left, hit the little link that says Future Shows. We should have the next series after our Best of 2017 up there, which is only a couple weeks away now. And then I think a series or 2 after that will be there. So yeah, welcometocomics.com. You can also from there go to our Patreon, patreon.com/welcometocomics. Support the show for a buck or a penny. Let us know you like us. Everything you contribute goes to our hosting and bandwidth operations for the show. Like, pretty much nothing goes in my pocket. Nothing goes to buying our comics. We buy these anyway because we like them and because we want to read comics. So you are literally just supporting the fact that this comic is getting into your ear hole. Not much else. You can also follow me on social media at Jolly Andy. Welcome to Comics is on Twitter and Facebook as at Welcome to Comics. Yeah, I think next week we've read Eleanor Davis once before.
Yes, she wrote How to Be Happy.
Oh, yeah. That was quirky and weird and good. I'm looking forward to this now. I was thinking it was the person who wrote Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? But that's Ross Chast. That was different. Yeah, now I'm looking forward to this more. Not that I wouldn't have looked forward to Ross Chast, I just don't want something that serious, but I'm for serious anyway. Anyway, I am looking forward to it because it's Best of 2017, and that usually does us right. So, until next week, everybody, goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye.